Welcome to the 84th episode of Reverse Rep Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chatwin.
It is 245 years to the day that the Hambledon Club, who were then cricket's lawmakers, limited the width of a cricket bat to 4¼ inches. This was to prevent players such as Thomas White, who had taken to appearing on the field with a bat as wide as the stumps. Welcome to the podcast with unlimited breadth.
It feels a bit like 245 years since we last recorded. It's not because we haven't been busily active, we can assure you. And we've got all sorts of things in this episode, the 84th episode of Reverse Rep Radio. But before we start, so I've been kind of travelling all over the place recently and have been not keeping up with anything in the world of cricket. I touched out off a plane about an hour and a half ago and looked at the internet for the first time in several days. And it seems as if some interesting things have been going on in the County Championship. Andy, you were there, weren't you?
Are you telling me that the people of Singapore weren't glued to the County Championship grand finale at Lord's?
If only.
What were they doing? Well, despite now living within a walkable distance from Lord's, I just really haven't had the chance to watch enough cricket live this summer. So when I found myself getting back from a holiday just in time for the final afternoon of the season, I practically jogged down. It was the perfect setup. You know, you really couldn't have contrived a better situation for the end of the season. Middlesex v Yorkshire, the winner to take the county championship, and on the final day, it's a very balanced game. A draw would hand the trophy to Somerset.
So you, was it not sold out, the ground? Were you able to get a ticket pretty easily?
It was, and it's an interesting point, actually. It was a very, very good crowd by county championship standards, but it was still very easy to get a ticket. I mean, one thing that was nice, and I thought this was a good sort of show from Middlesex, it was £5 tickets for the last day, and you were thinking, £5 to see what was just this, you know, fantastic setup,
the decider,
really good game. Yeah, and between two very good sides. But yeah, while a very good crowd by county championship standards, still some way short of a sellout. And I got there just after the tea interval, and Tim Bresnan is going really well for Yorkshire. I mean, he's had a phenomenal season for them generally. And as he struck consecutive boundaries, I was convinced he's going to be the hero. Yorkshire are going to get their third straight championship, repeat something that hasn't actually been done in the county championship for about 50 years. Then he goes LBW, and in that instance, it was pretty easy to give up on Yorkshire's challenge. They had really stressed having a very big bowling attack for this game at Lord's. They were very keen to make sure they bowled Middlesex out, so they had a very long tail, and an 8-and-over chase on a slow pitch suddenly looked too much. So at this point, Somerset looked favourites. Surely Yorkshire aren't going to lose 5 wickets in 10 overs. This is going to finish as a draw. But even with their chances of victory looking very slim, Yorkshire, who knew that a draw wasn't worth anything to them, just kept swinging and the wickets kept tumbling. And you could just hear this Middlesex supporting crowd getting more and more enthusiastic. Every wicket is greeted by a slightly louder roar, and suddenly everyone's looking around at each other thinking, oh, we might just do this. And then the key moment comes with about four overs left, when Andy Hodd, the Yorkshire wicketkeeper, just takes this massive mow across the line at Toby Rowland-Jones and is clean bowled. And at that point, you realise there's just no way Yorkshire are going to block this out. However small their chances are, they are just going to keep swinging. Very next ball, Ryan Sidebottom goes, and the title was Middlesex's. It's very hard to imagine the county championship will ever have a better finish. I think the genius of this was that you had both Middlesex and Yorkshire had no interest in a draw. It didn't help them. And you had this wonderful subplot of the players, the Somerset players at Taunton, sitting nervously watching the game there, wondering if they were going to get a celebration in case it did somehow finish a draw at Lord's.
And of course, they've had so much heartbreak over the last few championships, the Somerset team. And there is something about that kind of thing where a county season, you know, at the very beginning of the season, there are a few upsets and you know, what have you, but no one really sort of minds all that much. It's kind of early days, and then suddenly you get to the end of the season and all of this kind of this accumulation throughout the season, and suddenly every single ball matters, and there's a sense that this is the moment when the heroes are made. It's, I mean, there's nothing better than it in cricket.
Well, you talked about Somerset's heartbreak. I actually ended up watching, kind of by coincidence, a guy I played cricket with who had also turned up, and we met up and watched the final overs, and he's a big Somerset fan. And he was clearly mortified by what he was seeing, because they'd come so close. And I think it was desperately hard for a Somerset fan to watch Yorkshire pretty much tossing their wickets away at the end. But even he said at the end, he said, God, I just, you know, wouldn't have missed that. This is just brilliant cricket. And I think it says an awful lot about just the way cricket works generally. Whatever teams we may support, we're all really there just to watch brilliant cricket. And I think for me...
Just to appreciate a good game.
We did. And I had that sort of rare sense walking away from Lords. I had that very privileged feeling of having watched something live that I think in future will become a much thumbed page of wisdom in years to come. And I think, you know, we're having endless debates about what on earth we should do exactly with county cricket, and on a day like this you just thought, God, you know, let's just remember we have a wonderful sport here and let's not mess around with it too much.
So just talking on that front, because one of the things that did has struck me as being this new Cricket Unleashed strategy, which I'm just generally quite prone to feel pretty aversely towards anything that's a strategy that has the word unleashed in the title. I'm not sure being strategic and unleashing things necessarily go side by side. And this, for people who, you know, don't necessarily know it, and nor should you, the Cricket Unleashed strategy is ECB's latest kind of thinking around how on earth they're going to revitalize the game. You know, it's based on the premise that the game does need revitalizing, that something fundamentally different needs to happen.
It's based on the premise that a lot of money needs unleashing, presumably. That's I think, the
yes,
key.
Yes, indeed. That's into the ECB's pockets.
Yes, exactly.
That's really where it begins. And they've kind of had a first round of sort of voting on this, and there's been a forum that's been brought together to look at it. And the one big thing that's come out of it is this idea for the franchise-based, city-based 2020 annual tournaments that's going to be set up, that's going to run in conjunction with the NatWest T20 Blast. So it would be an additional tournament into the calendar rather than just an addition to the, rather than just replacing the existing one. And particularly in the light of what you were just saying in terms of the county game, it just seems so sad that we have this thing that, if you want to think of cricket in terms of products, we have this thing that is such a compelling product to so many people. But yet when we think about improving the game, we don't think about how we can better market that, how we can better, you know, make it more accessible to more people. We just automatically think, oh, let's go and create a new 2020 tournament. I just think it's an astonishingly kind of lazy level of thinking that suddenly, whenever we're thinking about accessibility and unleashing and money, that suddenly the first thing that happens is a T20 tournament that's going to be set up, which, as far as I can tell, is actually going to be in kind of direct competition. It's going to be another nail in the coffin for, you know, things like the county championship, which is just increasingly sort of disregarded on the side.
Agreed. And I mean, I understand we're already going to lose, if I understand this correctly, next season, we're already going to lose a couple of games a season from the county championship. It's going to be 14 games for each league rather than 16. And you're going to continue to have this slightly unfortunate thing of, we cram a lot of the county championship in at either end of this season. So we have a lot in April and a lot in September, or April, May and a lot in September. And frankly, we've been very lucky. We had a glorious September. But, you know, in another year, you lose so much to a wet April and a wet September. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we could talk about this for 10 episodes. I think we are going to get this city franchise-based T20 tournament. And if we do, then I hope it works and I hope it goes well. But it just seems that there's a limit to how much, I think, if you're constantly meddling, constantly changing a setup, I think it does become very hard to keep up with what you're following exactly. You know, you're
well,
following.
Well, I think it also becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, this thing of T20 is the thing that's developing and going to draw in the audiences. Well, of course it is, if it's the only thing that you're willing to put money behind and market and develop. Mm-hmm. And the other side being of, you know, the powers that be saying, oh, you know, county cricket in its current four-day format is a moribund form of cricket that no one's interested in. Well, of course it is, if you're never developing it and never marketing it and never actually driving people towards it. So it's, yeah, as I say, it seems to be a bizarre self-fulfilling prophecy. But, you know, onto much more important forms of cricket, which is, of course, our own cricket careers, which really is what this podcast is all about, just a kind of vehicle for us to talk about what we did at the weekend. So you must obviously be towards the end of your season now.
My season is now over. So yeah, my season has just finished. And I've had sort of pretty, I think polite is where I put it, a bit of a mixed bag of a season. I sort of got in amongst the runs. I had a really good season last year with the bat, and I did this season, I did whatever the opposite of kicking on is. I did. I had
failing.
Failing. I think that's it. And I sort of I pulled off a first this season, which is that I left a ball that hit the top of my own middle stump, which I've come to the conclusion is probably the most humiliating way to get out. You have very practically surrendered your wicket. And I can't blame my batting partner. I came in and he told me that this seamer was getting a few to jag back in. So I can't really understand my own reasoning where the first ball I received from this seamer just outside off stump, I left with relish, you know, a big sort of David Gower flash of a leave, you know, lifting my bat up clearly out the way, only to
probably
hear,
feeling very pleased with yourself,
feeling
for the,
very
for the
pleased
stylishness
with myself
of your leave,
yeah,
you know?
Only to hear the death rattle, and it, I mean, it, you know, it did come in quite a long way, but it's I was sort of thinking of sort of other sporting equivalents of it, but it's actually very, very hard. There's not many other sports that kind of allow you to kind of, what's the Japanese word for it? I think to basically commit harikiri, you know.
Harikiri,
isn't it? Where you sort of go out. And to do that, and also the other thing that sort of makes it particularly fun is we have well, I think you could just about call them a fan base at our club who also take a look, but they're the kind of fan base who take as much pleasure in watching the players bugger it up as they do in succeeding. So
they loved it.
That way it went down very well with the loyalists in the pavilion. But I was able to see the funny side. I think one thing I've learned this season is actually when you do slip into a bit of a bad run of form and you're kind of contriving different and more amusing ways to get out, one of the only ways to really deal with it is to see the comedy of it, I think.
Is just not to get het up. Yeah, exactly. Well, I've kind of got all of that to look forward to. I was supposed to have on my one day back in Sydney, supposed to play a game last weekend, first game of the season for the ABC cricket team. It's a beautiful day the day beforehand, and then on the day itself, of course, you wake up, you've put your batting gloves out the night before, you've ironed your whites, all of that, and and you know, you get up in the morning and the rain's bloody falling, of course it is, and anyway, the game wasn't called off, so I cycled to the ground in the hope that maybe something would pull through, and on the way cycling to the ground the game did get called off, but there are a few of us there and there's an astro net and it had sort of stopped raining, so we had a bit of a net, and it's actually struck me how glorious that feeling is of getting your body going again after the winter. Muscles that just haven't been stretched for months, muscles you've even forgotten about, hands that are just really unaccustomed to the ball and just have that kind of hardness where just sort of nothing sticks, the weight of the bat, the feel of the bat in your hands. And actually there is something glorious about your whole body's kind of getting ready and subconsciously limbering up and accustoming itself to the idea of the season again.
From the archives, and this episode, Toby is going to give us an introduction to a form of the game that is much loved but often forgotten, single wicket cricket.
So we've all played a version of this with our siblings in the garden when we were growing up, or those moments when you can't quite get a full team out for a club match and you just decide to do something a bit different from the 11-a-side format of the game. But it's always been single wicket cricket has always been something that's fascinated me, and it was only when I was researching this that I realised that in its kind of formalised version, it's truly one of the oldest forms of the game, and it's actually a key part of the development of cricket as we know it in the 21st century. So just one example of that, the middle stump, the middle of the three stumps that we have, was actually first invented in a single wicket game. So it was in 1775 that the wonderfully named Lumpy Stevens bowled out John Small three times in a row. Where would we be without Lumpy? And because in those days there were only two stumps and the gap between them was wide enough for the ball to pass through without touching either of them, it meant that Lumpy got a bit annoyed. So he basically, you know, got a hat trick without ever getting out poor old John Small. And it was because Lumpy kicked up a bit of a fuss about this that the extra stump that we now know today was added. So single wicket cricket, which is a mouthful in and of itself, really started thriving in the first half of the 18th century, and actually at that time it was the dominant part of dominant form of the game. And the reason for that was that it could very easily be bet on. So it was very essentially, because of its simplicity, there is always a winner, and there's always a very sort of simple winner. And in that sense, I suppose it's like 2020 today, where actually the the popularity of the game comes from the commercial imperative that that drives it.
I suppose the other great thing, if I'm an entrepreneur, and I know a lot of these were pub landlords, weren't they, putting this on, is that actually I guess I'm paying fewer people, aren't I? I don't have to pay
Indeed.
22 cricketers. I have to probably pay two cricketers quite well, and then probably five fielders who I'm paying pittance, if anything, aren't I? I mean, they're the kind of extras in this.
Exactly. So that's the that was the setup of the game. So there were two players who competed against one another, and then there was one set of fielders who they kind of shared. So often, actually, it was only two or three fielders. Sometimes it was up to five. Sometimes you actually fielded yourself. And so obviously what happened was that someone batted and someone bowled first, and you just batted for as long as you possibly could, scored as many runs as you could, and then you swapped over, and the person batting second batted as long as they could until they were out, and also, you know, tried to score more runs. So it's kind of a simpler form of the game as you can possibly imagine. It wasn't until 1831 that the rules were officially kind of codified and written down, and they're actually a fascinating read because they reveal quite a lot about the kind of nature of this game. And one of the things that really surprised me reading them was the fact that so much of the game is stacked in the bowler's favour. And obviously that's a significant difference from 2020 nowadays, where obviously the poor bowlers have it quite badly. So there are a few things. Firstly, the batsman has to run twice, so he has to run to the bowler's end and back in order to get one run. And in a day when, you know, pitches were, you know, not covered, full of potholes, everything else, and the bats weren't, you know, the kind of sprung versions that Shane Watson hits the ball 600 yards with, actually hitting the ball far enough to run all 44 yards there and back was, you know, no insignificant feat. Just one example of this, in 1846, Nicholas Felix, who was supposedly one of the great players of the day, was playing a two innings match, and off his second innings he scored four runs off 248 deliveries. God. Which even a kind of, you know, Chris Taveray, Jeffrey Boycott, Len Hutton would really struggle to
do. And I think have some account of how the crowd started to behave. They must have got near mutinous. And actually, as an effort for the bowler, that is absolutely staggering as well. That's one bowler sending down 248 balls.
And there was a rule that you could have no longer than 1 minute between balls. Again, something that's actually very reminiscent of T20 cricket.
Yeah.
But yeah, absolutely, that was hard on the bowler. But there are a lot of instances, again, as I say, where really it was the batsman who was on the back foot. The most amusing one of which is that, again, in these rules from 1831, they outline a thing called a no hit. So there's no such thing as a no ball that's talked about, but there's a thing called a no hit, which is equivalent of a no ball but for a batsman. And what that means is that the moment you hit the ball, you had to have 1 foot on the ground behind the popping crease. So what you couldn't do, you know, obviously this restricts pretty significantly your ability to move around the move around the wicket. The batsman could also only score runs if they hit in front of square on either side. And if there were fewer than five players on the fielding side, including the bowler, there were no byes or overthrows allowed. And one of the things that I think is quite interesting about the picture that emerges from these rules, and particularly from that sense of really kind of constantly disadvantaging the batsman, is of a thoroughly democratic game. So if we think about the way that cricket then developed in the 19th century, you developed into a system where you had amateurs and professionals, and it would always be the amateurs, the batsmen, who were, you know, the lords and ladies and earls and everything else who would go out and have a good time. And the people, poor people who were sweating away doing the bowling, were the professionals who were from the lower classes and who were paid. But what we're seeing in this one wicket form of the game is that actually that's completely leveled out, that actually as a batsman you don't have it easy at all. You really have to struggle to make every single run you possibly can. It's not just a case of turning up and hitting the, you know, poor peasants around and making them sweat in the field.
And also the pressure on your wicket is extraordinary, isn't it? Because you are one of the celebs, I guess, that's been hired for the day. And, you know, in a 11-a-side game, you give your wicket away as a big batsman playing an ill-advised shot. That's disappointing. You give your wicket away playing an ill-advised shot in this, and that's game over. You know,
Yeah, exactly. It's absolutely a game of patience and of attrition. Added to the fact of which is that enormous amounts of money changed hands on the results of these games. So, you know, there's enormous pressure that these players would have been under. And there are accounts of, so in the artillery fields in London, which is where a lot of, you know, cricket began to start. And as you say, there was an enterprising, it was owned by a publican, and there was an enterprising publican there who charged for entry and things like that in the, you know, early years of cricket being a sort of public sport. Mm-hmm. There are these accounts of these enormous crowds going out and playing this. So absolutely that thing of, you know, you would naturally err towards the cautious, and that's why you ended up having situations where, you know, for instance, a gold Nicholas Felix would score four runs off 248 deliveries.
Because the other way I see this as being an absolute promoter's dream is that, you know, I follow boxing, and you know, one thing you do in boxing in a major way is you really big up the personalities of the two individuals involved rubbing up against each other, their rivalry, this sort of thing. And obviously in a team game you can do that, but it's always slightly negated by the fact that it's 11 against 11. You know, when it's one against one, you can really make it, you can make it personal. You can say, you know, God, these two guys, they really don't get on. This is a grudge match to settle who is the best cricketer in South Wales or whatever, you know. So I can see that again being a real promoter's dream.
It's a marketer's dream, yeah, exactly. It did obviously come to an end. We don't really, you know, come across single wicket cricket other than through, you know, not enough players turning up anymore. One of the big reasons for that change was in the middle of the 19th century, was actually just the arrival of the railways with the increasing industrialization of England. And what that meant was that actually, you know, cricketers could link up with players from other, you know, from other villages. They could also travel to away matches a lot more easily and a lot more cheaply to play against other teams, and cricket became essentially a more social game. It also moved into the cities more significantly, where actually the idea of these individuals who were putting it out came second to the idea of these team sports. There was one moment when it came back in 1979, when in a kind of sort of gala game at the Oval, Clive Lloyd beat David Gower in a single wicket game. I mean, I always, when I think of that, I always think that, I mean, of course Clive Lloyd would beat David Gower, because I don't know enough about David Gower, but it doesn't strike me as much of a person to be able to bowl, you know, 248 deliveries in a row in any kind of particularly accurate way. But I think by the time that it had come back in 1979, it was definitely a sort of a relic from the past and a memorial of something from centuries ago, rather than a viable prospect for the future.
Could you ever conceive of it coming back, knowing what you know about it and how it did work, and knowing, you know, how what the game looks like today? Could you ever conceive of, because the game is very personality driven, you know, now, and I guess always has been, but you can imagine the crowd you could get for, I'm trying to think of the biggest cricketers in the world, but, you know, a sort of Mahendra Singh Dhoni versus Virat Kohli sort of game. You know, you have that at the Wankhede Stadium in Mumbai. You know, you think, do you think that's conceivable, or do you think the game's just gone too far beyond this?
Well, they do occasionally have tournaments in which, so I was reading actually an article I would thoroughly recommend on Crick Info, written by John Hodden, I think it was, which is about a single wicket cricket tournament. I've got to stop saying single wicket cricket, it sounds ridiculous. tournament that he played in Kent, I think, and that's, you know, very much done as a kind of sort of niche interest thing. I think the issue is that in order for the game to succeed in the format that the 1831 rules set up, it's basically a pretty boring game. Mm. You just have to sit there and block, and just, it's, you know, it's absolute epitome of hitting the bad balls and defending absolutely everything else. The name of the game is just to stay in. And, you know, so back then there obviously weren't boundaries, there weren't fours or sixes. If you lost a ball, then you actually got penalised some runs, so you were actually disincentivised from hitting it too far into the bushes.
Well, that's so real back garden really, cricket really... rules, isn't it? You know, lose the ball,
it
and
is,
get penalised. Yeah.
And if you break a window, God, that's, you know, bed without supper. So I think that if you were gonna bring it back, you'd have to really, really revamp the rules to make sure that, firstly, as soon as someone was out, you know, they weren't out first ball and that's game over. And also so that there was actually some incentive to be a little bit more aggressive towards it. review, and for this episode, we have been reading 28 Days Data, England's Troubled Relationship with One Day Cricket by Peter Miller and Dave Tickner. Peter Miller, who hosts, I was going to say runs and hosts at the same time, but hosts the cricket podcast The Geek and Friends and is a freelance writer. And Dave Tickner, who's a writer for sportinglife.com. He's your man to go to if you want any betting advice. And he is prolific on Twitter. That's mostly how he comes into my life. Now, at the head of this, I said, we have been reading. That's a total lie. I haven't read it. I've been on the road for the last several weeks, and I just haven't got around to it. It's as simple as that, and it only came out a couple of months ago. But Andy is much more diligent than I am, so can tell us all about it. Now, the title of the book, 28 Days Data, is inspired by the Peter Moore's quotation at the back end of the 2015 World Cup, when he was misquoted as saying, when asked why England had ballsed it up so comprehensively, "We'll have to look at the data." He said, "We'll have to look at it later." But on that data piece, Andy, how central is data to this book? Is this book an analysis of data around cricket and World Cups, or is it something a bit broader than that?
Well, it's kind of got a dual purpose. It is, on one level, the story of England in World Cups. And on that level, it's a really good read, actually. And I think for me, I particularly enjoyed, it's told in a very engaging way, and I particularly enjoyed the story of the older World Cups that I'm not so familiar with. And some of the interview material around them is excellent. But it's actually a much more ambitious book than that, and it seeks to basically try and come to the answer, why do England keep failing? And I think the central thesis is that it comes down to England's habit of abandoning long-held plans on the eve of a tournament. It's that, and also, more generally, England's unwillingness to just take one-day cricket seriously at all. I found it astonishing how consistently it's true that England got to a tournament or got very near a tournament and just threw everything out and just thought, God, let's bring some new players in, let's do this. And it's when you see the stories of the tournament lined up one after the other, you do see what an astonishingly consistent pattern that is.
Well, because that's really interesting, because obviously we're looking back at what kind of 20 years of actually, how long has the World Cup been going?
We're now talking kind of 30 years.
Yeah. 30 plus years. And obviously the England team has gone through, you know, the England team and set up and cricket culture in the UK has gone through an enormous range of changes since then. You know, the personnel and the cultures have changed. But you're saying that there are kind of patterns that are coming across in the way that we are kind of approaching these.
So the most interesting bit for me, I think, in terms of that, you know, trying to change the culture is what happened after the 1996 World Cup, which was a real humiliation on home turf in England. And there was a real attempt, it seemed like, to do things properly. So Adam Holyoake, a great one-day player and a very inspirational leader at Surrey, was made captain. And he was given a team of one-day specialists, really. Players who'd proven themselves at one-day cricket in the county game. And it's hard for us now to realise how revolutionary this was. One-day cricket was generally tagged on the back of a test series, and you generally just used the team you'd had for the tests. But the Holyoake story is fascinating because initially his team had some real success, but then the first sign of failure when they had a tough tour against a Brian Lara-inspired West Indies, and the ECB just dumped it. That was it. Back in with the test players, out rid of Holyoake. And I think it's a great indication not just of how hard change can be in cricket, but how hard change, I think, generally is in big organisations. That if you're trying to do something dramatically different, it does take a bit of courage and conviction. You need to stick with it. And it was very clear that the ECB really struggled to have that conviction, to really stick with it.
Well, there does seem to be a sense. I mean, one of the things that being here in Australia that a lot of people talk about is the fact that, you know, after Australia's complete failure at, I can't remember which Olympic Games it was. It was an Olympic Games, and they just failed to win any medals. And they just turned around and they just said, "Okay, we are just going to transform this entire thing." And they said, "Right, here's the 20-year plan for how we come up with a nation full of Olympic athletes." It happened. The same thing happened with cricket in the late 1980s when they, you know, established the whatever the Academy for Excellence or whatever it is it's called here, and they put someone in charge of it. And they said, "Right, here we go. We're going to have a 20-year plan." Whereas it's always struck me with England with one day, it's always, what's our plan up till the next World Cup? and then let's reevaluate and come up with another plan, because that hasn't quite worked, and then let's come up with another one. And it's just this kind of constant 3-year chunks where you make a plan, see it fail, make another one, see it fail, rather than that kind of longer time scale.
And I think that seems to be down to a combination of two things, and I think the book brings this out really well. They're genuine, and it feels a bit extreme to use this, but there genuinely feels to have been some considerable idiocy on the parts of those in charge, and they focus on when Paul Downton, who was then briefly the managing director of English cricket, he came out after the disaster of the 2015 World Cup and made this extraordinary statement saying that he had realised after this World Cup that T20 had had a big influence on the way 50 over cricket was being played. And the authors point out that everyone else had seen that T20 had transformed the 50 over game long before that tournament. The other side of this lack of a long-term plan is that, and the authors make this case, I think, very persuasively, that we in England, and it's on us as think as well as the fans, have just systematically not cared about one-day cricket to the same degree as Test cricket. Sure, we get a bit irritated about a World Cup failure, but actually, it's about the Ashes. It's about Test cricket. And one interesting part of the book is the authors try and take on this idea that this constant criticism, which I will put my hand up and I make very regularly, that ODIs often feel meaningless. And they make the point, well, actually, Test cricket is in its own way just as meaningless, isn't it? You know, it's really just a series of friendlies. It's not that, you know, it's not that in Test cricket we have a perfect league table that this all contributes to, and in ODIs we don't. You know, neither really have that system set up. But I think what they do admit, and I think maybe this is the key, is that they say the storied pasts of Tests imbues the endeavour with some greater meaning. And that, I guess, is what it comes down to. And I think that's a good explanation of why I will put my hand up and say I am the classic England fan who will love a Test series, you know, this summer's England-Pakistan series. And the moment we get to the one days, a little part of my brain switches off. You know, I'll keep engaging up to a point.
So just to go back to the title of the book, 28 Days Later, is the kind of conclusion of the book that by looking at English success, well, failure in World Cups for the last 30 years, you can actually draw conclusions from that, you can analyse it, and you can say this is where the next step should go, and that we've been failing to do that? Is it kind of as clear-cut as that in terms of the conclusion?
I think so. I think it shows the persistence of this, like, as you made the point, this persistence of this reluctance to plan properly, this persistence of this desire not to take the game seriously. But the game does make the case that the failure at the 2015 World Cup was more absolute than any other previous World Cup failure. Like, the level of humiliation, the level that England came up short in that tournament, has actually meant that a proper response has had to come. You know, I think it's this idea that you almost have to reach rock bottom and everyone has to see that this is a disaster before proper change is made. And I think the book ends on a very optimistic note that actually English cricket is changing. You know, we came back from that World Cup and had that wonderful ODI series against New Zealanders. You know, this book has come out not long after England came within, you know, a whisker of winning the T20 World Cup with a very exciting team. So I guess the other lesson from the book is that we failed a lot in the past and haven't ever properly responded, but maybe, just maybe, this time we failed so badly that we finally have.
So that's a happy note on which to end the 84th episode of Reverse Swept Radio. Thank you, as ever, for listening. So you can find all of our previous episodes on iTunes or over on our Podbean website if you want to browse through the archives. Otherwise, please do find us over on Twitter and let us know what you've objected to, what you've agreed with. And if you have enjoyed it, please tell a friend.